Moncrief on News Talk.
It is time for to bring you some stories from other parts of the world. Jonathan de Burka Butler joins us once again. Good afternoon, Jonathan.
Sean, how are you getting on?
Not too bad. Sweden we're going to go to first, where they're ditching plans to put 13-year-olds in prison.
Yeah, they had come up with an idea to put 13-year-olds in prison. So they've got a sort of centre-right government there, which is being made up of the moderates, the Christian Democrats and the Liberals, which is being supported by the Swedish Democrats, who did quite well in the last election, right? And the Swedish Democrats would be a little bit further right, shall we say, okay? And so it's a confidence and supply sort of arrangement that they have there.
Okay.
So I think most of this proposal probably came from the Swedish Democrats, and it was sort of championed, at least initially, by the government. But they realised that they weren't going to get the support that they needed to get this through Parliament. So all of the opposition was against it. And then it became clear that some of their own parties were going to vote against it. So they decided to drop this. And now they're going to go back and redraft the legislation and bring it down from 15 to 14 instead, right? And they're sort of saying, oh, this might make a difference. Now, the big question is, why did they do this in the first place?
Yeah.
And that is because, as you may or may not know, Sweden in the last couple of years, maybe 10 years, I'd say, has been actually having a bit of a problem with gangs, right?
Yeah.
Drug problems there in various parts of the city outside of Stockholm. You go to central Stockholm, you're not going to see any of this, basically, right? Really. And so an awful lot of these gangs have been using the younger people as mules, as is done here, right?
Yeah,
but it's
yeah.
become a particular problem there. And so in order to deal with that, the government said, OK, well, we need to crack down hard on these people. And the best thing to do is to throw them in prison instead of the current system, which is basically to send them to what are called youth homes. Okay,
okay.
So these would be kind
yeah.
of reform schools, but obviously they'd be a little bit looser. Now, if we look at the statistics, I mean, they do have a bit of a point. They have a problem, right? They definitely have a problem. There's been over 50 children under 15 appeared in court last year on either murder or attempted murder charges.
My God.
Over 50 children under 15. That is a huge amount. So it is a problem, and they've had to deal with it, but they've obviously decided at this stage that this is not the way to go. And obviously there are those who are encouraging them not to go down the route of bringing the age of criminal responsibility down to 14 either, because they say it's not going to do any good.
Yeah.
But there's a whole debate about that.
And presumably these gangs are recruiting these kids, and they're, you know, they're, and much like is happening in Ireland, they're targeting kids who would, you know, who might be vulnerable.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
But what critics are saying, and people who are sort of saying let's put them into prison rather than these youth homes, is that they're saying these youth homes are being infiltrated by gangs. And you can imagine it as well,
God.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Where you'd have maybe the alpha criminal, if you want to call them that, 15-year-old or 14-year-old in the institution, and then a young fella comes in, naive, his first crime, and he's promised all of these things when he gets out. You know, so they seem to think, at least the people who want this to go through, that putting them in prison will be better. But a lot of other people don't, and that actually includes the police, the prosecution authority, Sweden's prison and probation service were not behind this. So it didn't have an awful lot of support in the right places.
The violence itself is inter-gang violence.
A lot of it seems to be all right. Now, so the statistics are a bit weird, right? So there was one news article that I had a look at that spoke about, you know, the rise in murders having gone up from 87 in the last decade to 123 in 2023. But there was a spike in 2023 when there was a kind of an in gang war, if you want,
yeah.
a rivalry.
Yeah.
The biggest gang there, Foxtrot, I think they're called. They kind of had a split and they went at each other as a result of that. Now, the leaders of that gang and the one that split have both left the country. One was arrested in Turkey, I think. So it hit a spike in 2023 and then it came back down to under 100, I think it was, back in 2024. So those spikes need to be taken into consideration. But again, you know, you've got populist reactions to this kind of thing, and this is what they came up with.
Yeah. Right, we're going to go from Sweden, not too far away, to Norway, where the Crown Prince has been convicted of rape.
Yeah, so this is a case that's been going on for a while and one that I've been looking at for a while. And the chap in question is Marius Bordke Haby. He is the son of Norway's Crown Princess, And there's an important distinction to make here because he is the son of her, but not the son of the Crown Prince.
Okay.
So she came from a previous relationship. Exactly. Yeah. Now, he's 29 years of age and he had pleaded not guilty to the most serious accusations against him, which included 4 counts of rape. Okay. In total, there was 40 charges brought against him, right?
Word.
All to do with violence and sexual violence. Okay. And he was found guilty of 34, including 2 counts of rape. He got off for 2 others
okay.
For whatever reason. Okay. So he has now been sent to, he was actually convicted about 3 months ago, I think, but they brought him after a 6-week trial, which is, you can imagine, got everyday coverage in Norwegian media. But they brought him back yesterday and they sentenced him to 4 years in prison. So they're probably going to take time off for the time that he's done already because he was in prison during the trial. But it'll be 3.5 years and a fair bit of rehabilitation at least before he gets out again.
Yeah, and as you say, a bit of a media jamboree. And this seemed to be where he was, on the face of it, women were being drugged by him.
Yeah, what we know, at least in one case, because obviously the names didn't come out here, but one of the details of one case is that she was certainly asleep during one of the rapes.
Yeah.
The victim was, sorry. And there is a suggestion, all right, I can't say for sure, to be honest.
Yes,
if there was a drug involved, but I think there might have been. But these incidents, which is pretty depraved, were recorded and he kept these. So they ended up being used against him as evidence. He's a disturbed young man. Yeah.
Yeah. And I suppose interesting because in terms of a parallel with cases in other countries and what happened about that. But this chap had some associations with Epstein.
So the mother did. So
yeah.
His mother knew Epstein. She has been married to the Crown Prince since the early 2000s, right? And she had an association with Epstein for which she had to apologise recently.
Mm.
Now, she's also going through a bit of a personal crisis at the moment in that she has pulmonary fibrosis, so she's waiting for a lung transplant. But she had to apologise for those things with Epstein. I'm not saying that there's anything related between the two, that
course.
She's the cause of it or anything like that, but she had a fairly colourful past herself, which meant that she was kind of a controversial choice when she married the Crown Prince and has always got an awful lot of attention from the press there as a result.
Right. South Africa we're going to go to next, where Nigeria is telling its citizens to leave South Africa.
Well,
or is it the other way around?
They're not necessarily the Nigerian government isn't necessarily telling them to leave, but they're saying if you want to, we'll facilitate your repatriation.
Okay.
Right now, this is, I'll give you the details first, right? So there was a flight carrying 268 Nigerians which landed in Lagos. It had taken off from Johannesburg on last Thursday morning. And this is about the third or fourth flight that has taken people who've wanted to leave South Africa. So about 1,000 Nigerians have left so far. That's on top of people from Ghana, Zimbabwe, Malawi and Mozambique, I think, as well. Because of this xenophobia that seems to be going on in South Africa quite a lot lately. Now, I know, you know, President Trump has his thing about, you know, the white farmers being, you know, hung from trees and all that kind of thing. But there is this story of, you know, xenophobia going on where black Africans who are not South African are being intimidated. And there are indeed groups in South Africa that have organized themselves and they've launched campaigns basically saying that if undocumented migrants don't leave the country until or by the 30th of June, that there'll be trouble. And, you know, judging by the attacks that there have been on some some Africans within South Africa and the violence that they've had to not tolerate, but go through, you know, you can only imagine what's going to happen on the 30th of June. So people are scared and they're leaving and they're being helped to do so in this case by the Nigerian government.
Yeah. Now, would migration law into South Africa be slightly loosey-goosey anyway, or is it quite strict?
I don't know if it's quite strict. I mean, you've got to go through a process, you know, and get your documents together. Yeah. And if you don't have them, I suppose you are more likely to be sent home or whatever. But it seems that what's happening here, the crux of this, right, is the fact that the South Africa has an unemployment rate of over 30%.
In my word.
Right?
Yeah.
And migrants are being blamed for it. Mm. Does it sound familiar? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So we don't have enough.
And plus also South Africa would have a view of itself that it's a more developed country than the rest of
Africa. 100%. And it has to be said that there was quite a number of people did migrate to South Africa in 1994 when Mandela came to power, and the minority white rule when they got rid of it, because they saw it as an opportunity. You know, it is far wealthier, or it was at least, than a lot of other countries around it. But they are being blamed, these migrants are being blamed for everything that's gone wrong since. And it seems to be coming to something of a head at the moment.
And these Nigerians who are going home, these are undocumented people.
They are undocumented. Well, that's at least what the South African's border management agency said, that they are undocumented. Now, some of them have lived there for years. I mean, there was one woman that I read about. She's been there since 1998, and she's got a whole life in South Africa. And Nigeria, she'd be a stranger going back to Nigeria. Yeah. But, you know, some politicians are obviously very critical of what's going on, and they're telling people to calm down and stop these attacks. But then you've got Ramaphosa, the president, who made a televised address on Sunday. He was responding to the protests, saying, look, we need to, you know, be kinder. But at the same time, he said he was going to jail employers who hire undocumented workers. He said he's setting up a dedicated court to speed up deportations. So he seems to be leaning into this.
What proportion of South Africa's population is made up of migrants?
It's only about 10%.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Okay. Yeah. Right, I suppose it's London we're going to now, that this is a story that does involve Sierra Leone and that country's first lady and a flat there.
Yeah, so this is a woman by the name of Fatima Jabe Bio. Actually, she, speaking of Nigeria, she was a Nollywood star and a model in the past.
Okay.
She's in her 60s now, I think, and she's been married to the president of Sierra Leone, Julius Maada Bio. And they've been together since, I think, 2007, right? And he's been president since 2018. So they've been together a very long time, and he's had a very colourful past, and the whole family is quite colourful, shall we say. Mm. When he became president, they all of a sudden got very interested in real estate and started building these massive houses worth about $2 million and the like. Where they got it from, God only knows, but there we go. So she tends to, since he's been president, she tends to split her time between London and Sierra Leone. And she had a council flat in London, okay? She had a two-bedroom home in Walworth, which was run by the South Wark Council. Now, the Times of London did an investigation into her tenancy last year, and they found that she had been listed on the tenancy since 2007, right? So a good long time. And I know that the two of them did meet in London, and they spent a lot of time there fundraising, shall we say.
Okay.
So it's probably from around that time that it happened. But anyway, the Times did this investigation and they found that she really wasn't spending enough time there, because one of the rules of having a council flat is that it should be, you know, your principal residence.
Yeah, not a holiday home.
Exactly.
Yes.
exactly. Not a place where you take a taxi into Harrods and go shopping, for example. So they've launched the council, the South Wark Council launched an investigation. It lasted for 12 months and now they've come to the conclusion and they've kicked her out, essentially, and they have taken the flat back, and they're telling the media that they're going to give it to a family who are on the housing waiting list. And it is a huge housing waiting list, it has to be said.
Yeah, indeed, like many countries around the world. But she was there, and why did it take them 12 months? Or have they said why?
They haven't really gone into the detail of the investigation. They did not disclose details of the results of his investigation. They just made the announcement, said she's gone, and we'll be giving it to somebody on the housing list. But yeah, 12 months is a long time, all right.
Yeah. Right, Nauru is that we're going to go to next. That tiny little country wants to change its name.
Yeah, this is Nauru. It's about 3,000 kilometres northeast of Australia. Most people will know it because it was it's been used as a detention centre for migrants since 2001 by Australia, essentially, who were trying to stop them getting into Australia. But it wants to change its name, yes. And it's not a huge difference, it has to be said. So it's now called Nauru, and it wants to change it to Nauero.
Okay.
I don't think I'll go through that again, but Nowero is the new name that they're looking for. Now, the reason they're doing that is because this is the country in their own language. And they're looking at a bit of a revival or trying to get one going. They want to get rid of the shackles of colonialism. They want to get rid of the English name that they say, you know, was put there in the first place because it couldn't be pronounced properly by foreigners, and that it was changed in the first place, not by our choice, but for convenience. So they're getting rid of it. Now, it's passed through Parliament, right? They have a very small Parliament there, only 16 people, but they all voted for it, so 16-0. And they will now have to bring it to a referendum. When that's happening, I'm not sure. But most commentators believe that it will probably pass. So we will have to come to terms with that when we're covering it in the future.
Okay. Now,
Aero.
Yeah. All right. So it'll be a while before.
It'll be probably by the end of the year.
Itself,
yeah, but there are some institutions that are using the name the Postal Service and the National Health Service and that kind of thing are using the new name already. So it's a done deal.
Okay, it's a done
deal. Not in the Trump sense. It's an actual done deal.
For now, Eru. Right, so what's going to be happening over the next week or so?
Yeah, loads coming on this week. Obviously, it's 10 years today since Brexit, since they held the referendum, and they're partying like mad on that because it's been such a huge success.
Absolutely.
I have a feature in the Examiner today talking to some people who moved here or moved back here as a result of Brexit. So if you want to have a look at that, you can later on. Wednesday, that's tomorrow, the G7 summit concludes. It'll be interesting to see if anything amazing comes from that in the next 24 hours. And then Thursday, this by-election in Makerfield.
Well, we might get the new British Prime Minister.
So that'll be interesting to see. Then just one or two more. Sunday, this Colombian presidential election runoff is happening as well. It looks like this guy, De La Spria, is in the lead. Polls are predicting that he is going to win this. Mm. And if that's the case, you're looking at a kind of the Colombian version of Trump coming in there. Also, watch out for results in Peru. They've been slow. We were expecting the results on Sunday, but it's too close to call. There's only 18,000 votes between the two candidates at the moment.
Wow.
Keiko Fujimori, who's running for the fourth time, looks like she might get in, but you never know. She's been very close before and it hasn't happened for her.
Yeah, but with 18,000 votes, that might go to the courts after that one. Jonathan,
indeed.
Thanks a million.
Thanks, Sean.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.